This is episode 147 of That Shakespeare Life. Today's episode is brought to you by Experience Shakespeare. Experience Shakespeare is the membership arm of That Shakespeare Life that offers you monthly digital history activity kits that let you try at home the history you learn about on the show. They work like science labs for history. Stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm DJ Guba, Assistant Professor of History at Bard Early College, Baltimore, and I'm the author of the paper Acts from History, Executioners in Early Modern Europe. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
It's highly likely that the barber would play some part if a guy was going to have his beard styled, because not least for the reason that not many men actually have their own razors, certainly in this period. So, you know, you would tend to go and have the barber sort it out for you if you were going to have it styled.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Shakespeare uses the word beard in his plays over 100 times, and almost always as a way to indicate a man's status, power, or authority. In Antony and Cleopatra, Caesar is referred to as scarce bearded, as a slight against him by Cleopatra. Several times, the phrase, "by my beard," is used in plays like All's Well That Ends Well as an oath. And in Henry V, Gower refers to a specific style of beard being known as the general's cut. Throughout the works of Shakespeare, we see women swooning over men who have stylish beards, old men being cited for the gray or white color of their beards, and younger men with ambition referring to the presentation and style of their facial hair as an indication of their strength in battle as well as their position of authority. Portraits of men like Robert Devereux and Sir Walter Raleigh testify to the intricate detail on a man's face when it came to choosing and maintaining a beard. But what exactly were the fashion normatives for men's facial hair in the 16th century? When we say they cut them, what did they use for that purpose? Here today to help us explore how men wore their beards, the various styles that were popular, and exactly what kind of razors a man like William Shakespeare might use to acquire a style like the general's cut to his beard is our guest and author of Shaving and Masculinity in 18th century Britain, Alan Withy. Alan is a senior lecturer in history at Exeter University in the UK. He's an expert on the history of medicine and the body in 17th and 18th centuries, and has just completed a major study of the health and medical history of facial hair in Britain. His new book, Concerning Beards, Facial Hair, Health, and Practice in England, 1650 to 1900, is due to be published in February of this year. That's 2021. He has appeared on a wide variety of TV and radio shows across the world talking about his research, and also runs a blog at dralan.wordpress.com. He spells Alan with a U, so make sure you visit the show notes to find the direct link to his blog. Alan, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Specific styles of beards, like the general's cut mentioned in Shakespeare's Henry V, sound almost like they would take an artist to accomplish this and get someone's face to have this look. Alan, would a man like William Shakespeare have done his own facial grooming to get a style like this, or would he have gone to town to see a barber?
Right, well, some men might have trimmed their own beards a little bit with scissors or maybe given them a little bit of a brush, but actually, it's highly likely that the barber would play some part if a guy was going to have his beard styled, because not least for the reason that not many men actually have their own razors, certainly in this period. So, you know, you would tend to go and have the barber sort it out for you if you were going to have it styled.
We know that barbers in the 16th century were often also medical professionals in their own right, performing surgeries to the point of being called barber surgeons as a title. Alan, when a man during Shakespeare's lifetime visited the barber, would he have gone there for any type of cosmetic shaving to improve his physical appearance beyond just needing to shave his beard?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because you're absolutely right. Since the 16th century, the barber and the surgeon, the two occupational groups, had come together to become the barber surgeon. So he's actually a medical practitioner. And the barber barber surgeon is actually an incredibly important figure in the lives of men in this period, because it's the barber who does a range of tasks. So obviously they cut hair and they shave, but they also perform a range of other sort of bodywork tasks. So it's the barber who will dig bits of wax out of your ears, or scrape your tongue, or, you know, lance your boils and do all these different little bits of running repairs. And of course, the barber's shop is a very important place for men to gather and to meet, as well as to have these things done, the haircut and so on. But they can meet and gossip and have a drink and something to eat. So, yeah, the man would go to a barber for various different things. And as we said, yeah, to sculpt the beard a little bit and to sort of tidy up a guy's appearance above and beyond what he can do himself at home.
In his work, Shaving and Masculinity in 18th Century Britain, Allen writes, quote, "In 1653, John Bulwer had pronounced that shaving was not only an act of indecency, but also one of practical blasphemy, most inexpiable," I'll say that correctly.
It's a hard word, that one.
"against nature and God, the author of nature, whose work the beard is. For Bulwer, the beard was a natural symbol of the male and one which differentiated him from women, investing the face with authority and power," end quote. Allen, 1653 is close to 40 years after Shakespeare died, and a great deal of cultural change did take place in that time. So how reflective of Shakespeare's time period is this perspective on beards? Plays like Antony and Cleopatra seem to indicate the beard was a symbol of power in the 16th century, but was Bulwer expressing a new cultural perspective when he wrote these statements, or do they represent what someone like Shakespeare might have thought about shaving?
Pretty much Bulwer is sitting roughly about just about when things are about to change. They certainly, things remained consistent through the 16th and well into the 17th century. But from around the end of the 17th century, things begin to change and beard styles become a lot smaller. And they gradually end up with something like I'm wearing now, and then become the moustache and disappear completely in the 18th century. But certainly through a lot of the 17th century, the same would apply as it did in Shakespeare's time, where the beard is a so-called ensign of manliness, of manhood. It's a badge of manliness. So it is something that men would want to do. And even if they shaved it off, it's still very important that they should be able to grow one.
We see a perspective against shaving your beard show up in Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. Domitius in Abarbus remarks, quote, "Let Antony look over Caesar's head and speak as loud as Mars. By Jupiter, were I the wearer of Antonius's beard, I would not shave today," end quote. Allen, this line seems to support what you write with the quote from Bulwer, that shaving was associated with a removal of power, but also that shaving might have been a necessity, as Domitius's line indicates an expectation that Antony would shave eventually, not today, as the line says. So when we say men saw shaving as a removal of power, portraits from Shakespeare's lifetime show men with highly detailed grooming habits. These are not casual beards they have going on here. They are hardly the full mountain beard that you think of when you say a man hasn't shaved. So for Shakespeare's lifetime, what was the separation here between displaying your power through a beard and also shaving enough to be seen as a gentleman?
Okay, so there's a fine line to be trodden here between having a beard that's really unkempt and unruly and messy, but still needing to show that you can grow one. Because if you can't grow a beard in Shakespeare's time, then you actually run the risk, the suspicion of effeminacy, because it's a very important symbolic thing that a man can be able to grow a beard. And there are actually names for guys who can't grow beards, sort of insult names like smock-faced and imperbic. The two of the words used. So, you know, a beardless boy, if you like. So it's all about, as I said, being able to grow one. But equally, if you let this thing grow too wild, then you run risks of accusations that you've let yourself go. So there is a fine line. And as you say, a lot of the styles look quite, can we say, managed, that they require some work to keep them in trim.
In Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 2, the Duke of Gloucester says, quote, "Now by God's mother, priest, I'll shave your crown for this." And then in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, a similar expression of punishment comes up when Vincentio says, "Oh, death's a great disguiser, and you may add to it, shave the head and tie the beard and say it was the desire of the penitent to be so bared before his death." In both instances, there seems to be an association between shaving and punishment or preparing for execution, Vincentio even calling it a moral imperative, suggesting shaving would be done by the, quote, penitent. Allen, was shaving a man's head considered a sign of humiliation?
It's a really interesting one because I've seen a few references in passing to that effect. It's not something I've looked into myself. There's a couple of things, really. It could be a symbolic removal of men's hair, so, you know, in the belief that it may weaken them. But of course, the most usual wearer of the tonsure, the shaved head, would be a monk or the clergy. So it could almost be a mocking thing as well. But yeah, it is an interesting one, and I have seen references to it being a punishment.
In Shakespeare's As You Like It, Jacques and Touchstone reference a beard being cut well. Rosalind and Cecilia reference the value of a man being tied to the presentation of his beard. And Jacques in Act 2, Scene 5, references a soldier being, quote, bearded like a pard, all of which seems to indicate there were certain styles of beard associated with specific professions. You mentioned the tonsure being a sign of a monk or a religious man, or sometimes the style of beard might even indicate a man's status in society visually. Like you see him coming across the street and he's got his beard cut a certain way and you'd know where he belongs on the status rung there. Alan, were there specific styles of facial hair that men wanted to have? Like, I'm going to go to the barber and I'm going to get my face cut this way because it carries this symbol in the 16th century?
Yeah, there's a number of them, actually. I mean, you mentioned being bearded like a pard there, and that refers to the long beard of age and wisdom, and the biblical beard, if you like. So there's a connection there to age and wisdom. A full white beard on an old man can symbolize age and wisdom. But again, it's slightly ambiguous because it can also represent a body where the humors have dried up. So all the color's gone out of your beard and, you know, you're effectively on the slow run to the valley of death. Like, once your beard, I say this in the full knowledge that my beard's gone white as well. But there are specific styles. For example, the spade beard, which you would see if you saw Holbein's portraits of the ambassadors, very famous one, very sort of signal early Tudor style, which is a big square beard like a spade. And the symbolism there is it's the spade that's used to dig the graves of your enemy. So it's about your manly power. There is the stiletto beard, which again is similar to the one I've got here, which would be two pointy moustaches and a very pointy beard, which is meant to imitate a dagger. So it's a very, again, martial military style. You have guys with full beards, and you see those in the paintings of artists like Titian towards the end of the 16th century, and even a goatee. There are portraits with men with goatee beards. So there are all a number of different styles of facial hair. And yeah, they do have specific meanings as well.
Was the face the only part of a man's body he kept clean shaven as a matter of daily physical maintenance, or would he have shaved his arms and legs as well?
Again, not something I've researched in depth, but my feeling would strongly be that it was very unlikely that a man would shave any other part of his anatomy because of this risk of that perhaps over attention towards your appearance, and doing things that might make you appear more feminine would be risky.
I know that when it came to table cutlery, people tended to carry their own knives. Was this personalization of knives extended to facial razors as well? You mentioned earlier that a man would not usually have had their own razor.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, razor ownership really doesn't become widespread until the early 19th century, so the early 1800s. Razors don't start to be advertised for individual men until the middle of the 17th century, so, you know, quite a while after Shakespeare's time. So part of the reason for that is because they're quite expensive, but they're also difficult to maintain and expensive to maintain, so they need constant honing and stropping to keep them in good order. So it's just actually easier for guys to go to the barber.
What kind of razor would have been used when you went to the barber for shaving? Was just a straight razor, or was there something specific?
They would be either a straight razor or something that folded back into the handle. So they'd almost universally be made, the blade would be made of steel, and the handle could be anything sort of wood, shell, brass, nickel, things like that. So they could be quite decorative. But some razors, as I said, folded back to become clasped razors, like a cutthroat, if you like. But that's basically the only style there is. There are no safety razors. There's stories of people in other cultures shaving with seashells in non-European countries, certainly. There's even stories of some men, Chinese men, for example, plucking out their beard hairs, which if any guys have tried that, they'll quickly realize how unpleasant that would be if you had any growth of beard.
So you mentioned that men wouldn't have owned their own razors, but what about things like shaving creams or aftershave? Were there any of those that got used for a man to shave?
Again, there's nothing commercially available until late into the 18th century, but the barber, you do see in remedy books, things like creams and unguent pastes and things that the barber could actually put on a man's face, but it would be the barber that would do it. And, you know, he might possibly sell something to a guy, but it would be something along the lines of stuff called pomatum, which can be used for hair as well. Sort of like a cream. They may be scented slightly, but there's certainly nothing like aftershave until, again, late into the 18th and into the 19th centuries, not in the way that we understand it.
And I assume because of the barber surgeon's medical background, he's mixing these things a lot like potions or medicines right there in his shop. That's impressive.
Yeah, and some of the work I've done is on barber's probate inventories, which, for anybody who's not familiar with those, when somebody died, people would go into their house, or if they had a business, their shop, and make a list of what was in their shop for the purposes of probate wills, if you like. The better versions of these can be really, really detailed. And sometimes you do see things like paste pots, unguent pots, lotions, and things like that listed individually. But it's quite rare to get that level of detail. But I have seen them.
I know we would love to explore this further and look into the world of facial grooming and beard styles for Shakespeare's lifetime. What are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use to learn more?
There's a growing literature, excuse the pun, on the history of beards. My book concerning beards is actually coming out next month, but Christopher Oldstone Moore, I believe you've had on your blog before, a great book covering a very long time span. Looking at the history of beards. A friend of mine, Lucinda Hawksley, and her book on beards, moustaches and whiskers. And then for those of you who are feeling slightly more academic, there's been some studies, for example, Mark Albert Johnston's book, Beard Fetish in Early Modern England, which is all about actually Shakespeare's plays and the representations of beards in there. And there's some great resources on the internet now and some lovely discussion forums, such as the Straight Razor Forum, where they actually have examples of old razors on there and pictures of them. So there's lots of things. A bit of judicious Googling will bring up many, many interesting little articles about them. Of course, my blog as well, if you want to find out some specifics too.
Absolutely. We definitely want to visit that. And we will have links to Alan's work as well as the episode we did with Christopher Oldstone Moore, along with some of these old shaving forums and images so that you can find them quickly, all packed into the show notes for today's episode. So make sure you go there to find them. Alan, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be, in addition to those.
Okay, so I'm going to cheat very slightly here, but only very slightly, and I'm going to say Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy in its original form of the single book. So I think there'd be enough to keep
well
me going
done.
There for quite a while.
That would be very good. You'd be well set up on your deserted island for sure. So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
So I've been working on beards for probably 7 or 8 years now in one form or another. So I think I've done my bit for the history of beards. And the next thing I want to look at is actually the history of advice to medical advice to travelers. What were people being told before they went off on journeys from sort of the early modern period through to the 19th century? So that's going to be, I think, my next project.
Well, Alan Withy, we will look forward to seeing your research come out. I know as much as we've enjoyed your research into beards that we will enjoy your medical advice to travelers as well. Thank you so much for being here and talking with us today. This is a fun conversation.
Pleasure. Thank you, Cassidy. Thanks for having me on.
Find links to Alan's work, links to Google forums on those straight razors he mentioned in today's episode, as well as a free ebook all about Elizabethan beard styles. You can also find links to the episode we did with Christopher Oldstone Moore, who talked about other beard styles like the Van Dyke, which we didn't mention in today's episode, all packed into the show notes. So make sure you find that bonus history and grab your copy of this ebook at CassidyCash.com/episode147. That's CassidyCash.com/EP147. How would you like to see the video of this week's interview? You can watch this interview, as well as other exclusive interviews not available anywhere else, right inside That Shakespeare Life app. That's right! That Shakespeare Life is now streaming on our very own digital app. We are very excited to make this available, and not only can you stream podcast episodes anywhere you go, but the app contains exclusive content like activities, games, documentary shorts, expert interviews, and animated plays, all free from ads and available anywhere you you might be. You can learn Shakespeare's history from the experts who know him best while you're in the carpool line, cooking dinner, or even while you're working out. Take Shakespeare history with you wherever you go, all without any commercials. Download the app now at CassidyCash.com/experience. That's CassidyCash.com/experience. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.